Okay, week five, welcome everybody. Same sort of agenda items. Today we're going to have a 100% Stanford homegrown lectures, and it's going to be in two parts, so it's a little bit different than before, but I'm sure you can handle it. Comments on presentations are welcome and helpful. Just email them to me. For those working on projects, the assignment one is due on Friday in Professor Nelson's office. Slide it beneath the door. And there's still a couple teams who haven't set up a meeting time for our midterm meetings. So those teams, I'm looking forward to hearing from you. And one thing I'd like to do for the remainder of the quarter is institute weekly meetings with the project teams. And again, it's not going to be for very long, 5 or 10 minutes per week. And this could be done right before or after class or at a time of your choosing. So please let me know what is most convenient for you. This is to make sure that everybody's going to be on track and I can provide the maximum amount of information so that you can have an excellent project. And you've seen this before. Next week we're going to have Jeff Schock talk about patents. And you may wonder why in a course on assistive technology we're going to be talking about patents. Well, it's because that during this course and subsequent courses you may be developing project ideas and projects. And in the space of in business, that's intellectual property. And you should be aware of your rights and limitations on anything that you develop either at Stanford or when you're out in industry. So this should be pretty illuminating if you haven't been through this subject before. So that's next week. Any questions on any item so far? Okay, let me start the sign-up list around. And the handouts. And this is the wrong one. Well, next week we have Jeff Schott, but this week we have speaking first is going to be Terry Adams, and she's the assistant director of the Office of Accessible Education right here on campus. And the center is provides Stanford students with disabilities the support and services needed for them to participate in the rich and varied life at Stanford. And in addition, she helps with academic accommodations for students, and that includes housing assignments and facilities requests related to disability. And she was instrumental in getting the class this room, which has more accessibility than the room we used last year. So she's also been a pretty frequent visitor here at both this year and last year at all the lectures. So she knows what we're talking about. So let me get out of this and bring up her talk. And then we're going to also give you this.
Yeah. Try not to run over it. Okay. Hi. Okay. I'm going to do a presentation that's more fun than substance today, because I think talking about accommodations in a higher ed setting is a lot more involved, both the concepts, the legal issues, and the scope of what we do is a lot more involved than is appropriate for this class. So I decided to go a different way and just do sort of talking about an experience I had this summer, summer of 07. I went to a conference in Innsbruck, Austria, and by myself, and it was very illuminating for me just in terms of reinforcing a lot of the things I thought about, coping skills, problem solving, how to figure out what's going on. So that's what we're going to look at. These are sort of my general thoughts about assistive technology. I know that in this class you guys are really looking to be creative and trailblazing and things like that. But as a consumer, I'm always looking at how much is it going to cost? Am I going to have to pay for it? And things are getting tighter and tighter in terms of insurance paying for assistive technology of any kind. I was telling Dave, I just got this new wheelchair. My old wheelchair was going on 6 years old. It took me 8.5 months to get this wheelchair, even though I've been using power mobility assistance since 1996. The insurance companies, and I have the same coverage I had the last time I got a wheelchair. They just do not want to pay for anything anymore. And so if you're looking at really specialized devices, even if you have the best idea since sliced bread, getting it to the end user, if it's expensive and exotic and hard to maintain, is going to be almost impossible. And if that's what drives you, actually getting something to somebody that will improve their quality of life, then you need to think about that. And so my idea is think about things that help everybody. And that's Molly talked about universal design. Since to the average person, mobility issues, then you're much more likely to get somebody to pay for developing, making enough of them so that the cost is not prohibitive. So those are the kinds of things that I think are real world things you need to be concerned about. So that is a shot of Innsbruck from a 6 or 7 story building. And this is the conference that I went to was the International Conference on Higher Education and Disability. And this is, they have it every 2 years. And I think this was the 6th or 7th one. And we were specifically talking about clinical accommodations for students with disabilities, my panel. So the first thing I decided when I was clear I was going on this trip was not to take my power chair, because I took a different chair to Las Vegas one time, and when I got there, it was tweaked, and it took airplane mechanics an hour to get it going again. And I didn't want to be in Frankfurt, Germany, with a dead wheelchair that weighed 500 pounds. So I decided to take a manual chair, and I had to buy it myself. That's just a picture of, basically, it's a generic chair. This chair, the retail price on this chair is about $7,000. There's huge markup. I mean, there's all kinds. It's a refuge for used car salesmen if they can't sell cars. It's bad. It's really, really bad.
It's a wonder that more people with disabilities don't go postal, I swear to you. So I experimented, and the summer before I went to a conference in San Diego, and again out of pocket I bought this thing called the Atom, which is, I think, really patronizing, like, Attaway. And it's cute, and it's good in casinos, I have to say. When you have totally flat, low-pile carpet, it's great. But other than that, it's pretty well a lawn chair. So I tried to, when I got to Innsbruck, I was shocked to find that it was pretty flat, even though it's surrounded by the Alps, and it has a lot of rudimentary curb cuts. And I was so frustrated because I would have just gone all the hell all over the place if I had had my power chair. So I tried to rent one, and I could not get a vendor. Somebody talked to one vendor who was willing to loan it to me if I could give him a deposit of 3,000 euros. So I bagged that idea, and I got Mary instead. And that actually turned out great. And that's my hotel room. I was really pleased. Now, the room was huge. Two weird aspects of the hotel right away. First thing was that it's an older hotel, and they've, you know, refurbished it and added onto it and all that kind of thing. I didn't take a picture of this. I wish I had. There was a threshold on every door of about an inch. And so the only way I could get myself in and out in the chair was to back it out. The other thing that was funny was they had four elevators. There was only one that went to my floor because they were staggered. So if I was on the ground floor and I wanted to go to my room and the wrong elevator came first, I had to wheel into the elevator, and they're little tiny boxy elevators, wheel in, push the button, back out, send it away, and wait for the elevator to come. And I just thought all the tourists standing around watching me just must have thought I was completely insane. So this was the most amazing bathroom. I was just stunned. It was huge. You could have bowled in there. Really, really accessible. Great roll-in shower. And that's the corner of a full-size big tub. Fold-down bench for the roll-in shower. Only one thing. The countertop was like this high on me. So fortunately, I can stand up to do things like brush my teeth, but I thought it was pretty funny because they thought of everything except how high the counter was. So, assistive technology 101. This is what I brought with me in my suitcase, and I was so glad I did. They don't have cans. If it's a can, I could pop it with, you know, anything. Key, pen, letter opener, scissors. But if it's one of those twisty things, I just can't do it. So I travel with one of those jar openers. These are both OXO. And this is the kind of stuff. Think about this stuff. You could sell a million of them. You know, they're like $6. One of the things when I decided... It was an interesting process for me as a disabled person who's really, really independent, deciding to hire somebody to push me around town. I felt really weird about it, and I've never had anybody, you know, as a personal attendant before. And all she was doing was pushing my chair, and I still felt weird about it. But what I did was I thought about what I would tell a student here at Stanford, you know, maybe they use a power chair and their power chair breaks and they need to get around campus. What am I going to tell them to do? I'm going to tell them to hire somebody to push them around. So that's what I did. But the people that hooked me up with her, she was a student at the local university where the conference was being held, thought she should do it. And so after about 3 hours, we would stop somewhere to have coffee, and I said to her, did they talk to you about, because I said, I had told the person who I'd asked to help me find someone, I said, you know, I'd probably pay them around my equivalent of $10 an hour. And she said, oh, no, it should be free. And I said, no, it's a business transaction. I will pay her. So I raised the issue, and she said, yeah, she was very odd about it, and she thought I should do it to be compassionate. I said, no, this is, you are providing a service, I'm going to pay you. And so we got along even better after that. And the thing that was kind of disturbing to me about it was that this person that thought she should do it to be compassionate was also a person with a disability, although she had an acquired disability, and I think that had something to do with it. I made a mental note. I was going to say, for those of you that were here for Gary's talk, Gary Karp, I think when you are, if you're interviewing people, talking to people about your projects, it's worth knowing whether they have an acquired disability and how long ago they acquired it, or whether they were born with their disability. I was born with mine. Mine is a genetic mutation that causes skin cells to be produced too fast, and then they don't break down properly. And it causes mobility impairments because you get blisters on your feet from walking. And now I've got a whole new set of problems because I'm aging. And the dermatologists have no clue. They just have no clue. I want to admit a couple months ago that everything they told my parents to do when I was little was wrong. So, having a disability my whole life is very different than someone who acquires a disability when they're a teenager or an adult. And so it's something to keep in mind when you're working on projects and talking to people, what their perspective is, whether they're trying to get back to the functionality they had when they were able-bodied, or whether they're just trying to improve what it is for them, the status quo. So it's really worth thinking about. That the whole trip, and I have to admit it wasn't that bad, but it was infuriating. And if I had been able to run up two flights of stairs, I might have gotten myself arrested. But I was flying from Frankfurt to Innsbruck, and it's a little commuter, Tyrolean Airlines, and but Lufthansa was responsible for getting me from the Lufthansa terminal to the Tyrolean Airlines plane. And I told them, you know, I'd scheduled everything, so I had like 2 or 3 hours in between flights, and I showed up with my wheelchair, and I told them what I needed. And so finally they're going to do pre-boarding, and they take me in the manual chair to the top of two very steep flights of stairs. And she says, can you walk down the stairs? And I say, yes, I can. Is there no elevator? So you can walk down the stairs. Yes, I can walk down the stairs. So I walk down the stairs. There's a shuttle down there. I say, in a week I'm coming back. I can't walk back up the stairs. And she says, well, this, you know, basically her thinking is, I think, I won't be here. I won't have to deal with that. And I said, but is there a plan? And so she's trying to get rid of me, and I see a wheelchair symbol over it. And I say, I've got to go. So I get on the shuttle, And I'm sitting there in the front row, not real happy. And the elevator doors open. And it's my wheelchair. So when I came back, it was a totally different deal. They brought an accessible shuttle to the plane. And they brought me into this area that was clearly for people with disabilities and I think also people that were sick. And so I told this whole story to the guy that was on duty, and he was like, oh, it's not supposed to happen that way. And I said, yes, I know. So that's the kind of stuff you got to keep bobbing and weaving all the time. And, you know, when you go through security, I always debate about whether to tell them I can stand up or not. Because once they, there are still a tremendous number of people that think that if you're using a chair but you can actually walk a little bit and stand up, that you're malingering. And there's still a real either-or mentality. And I'm hoping that with the aging boomers and the spectrum of disability will become more obvious to more people as that happens. Does anybody have any questions? Well, I had to appeal, and my last chair cost $8,700, and I didn't have any copay. And this time, it cost, and this time, I went through a nightmare of using the same vendor I'd used last time, who ordered the wrong chair and wanted me to pay $4,300 for a $10,000 chair. I had to unwind that transaction and do it with another vendor. And by then, I was a lot more savvy about the markup on these things. And I said, look, I know now for certain that I have a $5,000 cap on this, and I don't want to pay much over that. But I found out that the retail price that you'll find online, they pay 30 to 40% less than that. So the profit margin is huge. The reason, what's happening now, and I didn't know about this till it happened to me, is that there was a Medicaid case, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago, but and I don't know if it was the Supreme Court or the Supreme Court of a particular state. I've not read the case. They determined that because the plaintiff in the case could get around her house, that Medicaid had fulfilled its obligations to her in providing services. And whenever a decision like that happens for Medicare, Medicaid, the insurance companies glom onto them and try to only deliver that level of service also. So what they said was two things. One is, in the fine print, you'll see that the cap is now $5,000. They tried to tell me that it had always been that, but since they paid $8,700 before, clearly it wasn't always that. But they also said, well, we only have to get you around your house. And I said, that's insane. I work full time. I've been using this kind of equipment for over 10 years. And I don't know exactly what caused them to overturn it. I half expected to have to fight it some more.
Some introductions. Wow.
Hsu and Emily Fetcher. And, sorry. Okay. Gene is a second-year student in the Joint Program on Design here at Stanford and will receive her degree in product design in the spring. And her background is in EE with an MS from the University of Texas. And she also has industry experience in developing a laser-based debugging tool at Intel. And currently she does need finding and design research for Google and a PC startup in China. And Emily is also in her second year and will be receiving her MS in product design as well. Her background's a little bit different. She's a mechanical engineering student from Dartmouth, and has extensive background in the outdoor industry, and recently worked at the Black Diamond, where she introduced need finding as a designer in R&D. And both Gene and Emily were exposed to need finding at Stanford and took a particular interest in this approach to design, and they've worked together to on a number of projects, and one most interesting to this class was evaluating the needs of a one-handed cook and designed some cookware to serve that purpose. And so without further ado, this is Jean.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, sorry. So thanks again for having us here. As David described, we wanted to share with you a tool that we use a lot in Stanford design methodology called need finding. Have any of you taken need finding ME216A? Have any of you taken a D-School course?
Yeah.
Okay, anybody happen to be an ethnographer or interviewer or in anthropology? Okay, so to let you guys know, we're just going to give a very brief overview of what need finding is. And there's a whole course, like I said, devoted to this if you were really interested in getting deep into it. Elements of it are used in the D-School and projects there as well. But the idea is that we would be able to share with you some tips and tools that you can take back with you to work on your projects, for your projects. And so what is need finding? It's kind of what it sounds like. It's finding needs. For users, but not just any needs, but implicit needs, those that are hidden, not obvious, hidden under the surface, that really get to the core of what helps somebody. So as David mentioned, we're in the joint program design, which is a joint program between mechanical engineering and fine arts departments. And the approach that we take there and that we've been studying is a more human-centered approach, which is based upon need finding. So let's get right into it. We're gonna start with a little exercise, actually, to get your observational juices flowing, and start with talking about a story about an individual named Leah. Leah is 26 years old, and she does research in sustainable agriculture, and she's also an avid climber. And she had a climbing accident where she shattered her shoulder, and she was out for about 3 months. And this is a picture of Leah in her kitchen. So the first exercise we wanted to do is just have you take a look at the picture and pick out all the details, notice the objects in the room, notice what she's doing, notice all the little things happening here. And I'd like to have you just tell me what you see and state what looks normal and not. Go ahead.
Her left arm is in a sling.
Yep. Anything else? Yeah. Quite possibly. Anything else? See anything else? Yeah.
Virtually everything that she has on that table needs to be held when she opens the lids.
Correct. Yeah. Very good observation. Anything else? What else do you see? Yeah. She's staring at a dish towel probably right now. Anything else? What else do you see? Can you give me some details about the environment? So if this is in our... Yep. Okay. Any other
details you'd like to you see?
The
good point.
Yeah,
yeah, good question.
If it had just come out, we had made coffee.
I'm sorry?
It is.
We thought it would be a little easier to look at than the other way around. So. Any other things you notice? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, yeah. Another very interesting point, yeah. Another good point. Really good observation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the way to the table. Any other observations? Great. Okay. These are all really great observations. And so what we want to do at this point is to kind of switch over to need finding mode. And so to do that, we're going to start with a pretty simple rule, which is a kind of grammatical thing, which is we'd like to start to speak about Leah's needs in terms of verbs. And the reason we do that is just a simple distinction to help separate needs from solutions, because solutions usually are described in terms of nouns. And so, like, a quick example would be, like, if I were, you know, at the store and there's a wall of products and I'm looking for spaghetti sauce and I want a specific kind with mushrooms, and I see it, and it's, you know, and I'm heading for it. It's way up there. And so if I, you know, freezing that image for a second, you know, first thing that might pop into your head is, oh, she needs a stepladder. Perfect. And so what happens, though, if you speak about those type of needs in a noun form, you start to think about just that thing, a stepladder. Stepladder, a tall ladder, moving ladder. But if we are able to speak in verbs instead, for instance, that I'm, you know, I need to reach for something at the top of the shelf, we're able to open up the solution space, open up the possibility for different types of solutions, like, you know, bringing the shelf down or moving all the cans to a different place or maybe giving an extension to my hand. So just as a kind of simple rule from this point forward, to try and think about needs in terms of verbs. In order to help frame the situation for yourself.
So now that we have an idea of what needs are... Hold
on.
You're close.
Yeah?
Okay, well, Jean's going to... I think this is for prosperity. but Jean's going to write some... But Jean's going to try and write these things on the board. But... Can you guys start to throw out, what do you think are some needs? What needs do we see in this picture?
Holding.
Okay. She has a need to hold. What else?
A need to twist,
a need to twist, a need to twist a handle. Okay, so to lids. All right. What else do people see? There's a need to cut. A need to see. That's interesting. A need to steady something. What other kind of needs do we see in this picture that might have to do with maybe some of the other details in the room? Okay. Need to pour? She needs to eat. That's interesting. That's maybe not exactly what we're seeing in the photo, but she has a need to eat. And that's a great example of what we might call a higher level need. So it's not really specific to the situation, but it's a higher level need that is actually common to all of us. We all need to eat. That brings up a great point. When we talk about needs, we talk about needs in different areas. So at the top, we have common needs that everybody has. And then kind of you dig a little deeper and you have this idea of cultural needs. Probably for all of us, we'd have similar cultural needs. And then maybe in the context of a situation like a kitchen, there's another set of needs that are a little bit more specific. And finally, kind of down at the bottom is this idea of specific needs. And we start thinking about those needs and how they might relate to a product. We think about things like towards the top, these common cultural kind of relate to meaning. What is the meaning behind something? And if you think about product, what that relates to is the form that a product might take. And the next level down would be use, and use needs are what the function of a product is. And that's the space that us as mechanical engineers spend a lot of time in. And then if we're really good mechanical engineers, we like to think about usability. And usability has to do with what the details of the product might be. So if we think about this picture, which I hope you guys can still see, but you can see Gene better now, which is great. You know, you might notice there's specific needs for this situation where she's cutting the bread because she obviously needed a cloth for some reason. We might think, why is that? And an easy way to, once we have a couple needs that are interesting, to dig deep into them and to open up your problem space, as Gene was talking about, was to ask two questions. How and why? If we look at saying the need to cut the bread, and we ask why does she need to cut the bread, then that brings up to this higher level need of she needs to eat. Does that make sense? Does anybody? So if we look back at the situation, we look at some of the needs we've already got on the board, can we get to any newer needs, maybe higher level? Yeah. She needs some safety. Yeah, that's a pretty common need to be safe. You were going to... So let's try and phrase that. It's a lot of really great stuff. Let's try and phrase it as a need. Okay. Need to protect yourself, maybe? Need to protect? What about, you know, she's slicing bread, but wouldn't it be easier to buy sliced bread? What's going on there? Is there a need behind that? But how is that preference? Can we try and put that in the form of a need? Because it was a choice that she made, right? Yeah.
Quality.
So what's going on there? Maybe in her mind she has a need for a certain type of quality. Yeah. So just because, you know, what I'm trying to get at is that it's not just about her cutting bread and how she's going to do it. It's also about these other things. The fact that, you know, you might notice things in her kitchen. Her milk comes in a glass jar. She's got some canning going on, a lot of cookbooks, some cloth sacks. And these are all part of her life. And those preferences that are all part of her life are going to inform the products that she wants. Yeah. Well, I recreated the scene. But, yeah, she does have that need to be independent, and she does live independently. Yeah, it's part of her identity, and that's really important. So we asked how, I'm just going to show you another really quick way to use it. So if we go back to that need of to cut bread, and you ask, we asked why, and now we're going to ask how, which kind of digs down these details. So if you said, how does she cut the bread, what's going to fulfill that need? To hold the bread. And that's where you start getting at some of these usability needs. Like in this case, she has the towel there because the bread was digging into her forehead and it hurt. And so she put the towel down. So you guys, that's great. You guys kind of uncovered that. But what's really interesting is that this need to hold the bread is magnified in this situation. If it had been me and I'd been cutting the bread, I would have done this and you might not have noticed that need that she had to hold the bread. And that's a really important point, and that's kind of something that Jean's going to talk about in terms of why we study who we study. So
on that note, we're going to present, I think, is our next set of...
We'll stand next to each other now.
So this story that Leah provided was really an inspiration for us, because we actually started out actually having a project where we were meant to design cookware. And we're like, oh, you know, maybe we'll, like, look into cutting boards or, like, you know, knives and things. And then heard the story from Leah, and we were really inspired, and we thought, you know, to really to grab onto, like, what is really interesting needs that exist there. We wanted to look at what we call extreme users. And so that's just taking an extreme situation or set of kind of extreme needs or users who have needs that almost everyone has but are magnified. And so looking at those kind of extreme situations. And so we were inspired to look to study cooks cooking one-handed in the kitchen. And so three individuals that we were able to seek out all through the Stanford Hand Clinic and also some prosthetists in the area were Joan. She had her her left hand reattached after an accident where it was severed. And then Chris, who was in a motorcycle cycle accident where he lost use of his right shoulder and arm. And finally Ramona, who was born without the use of her right hand, or without a right hand. And we spent a lot of time with these individuals, hours in their home, hanging out with them, cooking, and learning about, you know, what their needs were. And to take a moment to talk about interviewing and spending time with your users, definitely the more time you can take, the better. And also taking a moment to distinguish, you know, what they say versus what they do and taking a moment to also empathize with the feelings and the thoughts that are going on in reference to what their actions are and what they say they're doing. And what's really most interesting is picking out kind of disconnects or moments of either things that don't quite usually line up together or contradictions or and those are usually end up being very interesting places where you can start to get inspired to find out, to dig deeper on what those underlying needs are. And also to really allow your users to just talk. And that's another kind of way or technique to get at some of those hidden, more implicit needs that that don't, you know, come out when you're like, so, what do you need in the kitchen? You know, and that won't necessarily be the most fruitful approach. The one that we find the most helpful is just to be in the environment and the setting in which people normally are and have them, behave in the way that they feel most comfortable. So we have some video clips to show of some of the interviewing that we did with Joan and Ramona and Chris, and we'd like to share that with you. And then you could, if you'd like, to take a few notes or kind of mentally go through what are some needs that I'm hearing, you know, in these clips. In reference to all the different levels that we just mentioned, you know, in terms of common needs versus specific needs, and then what's the meaning behind what they're saying or they're feeling, the use also of whatever it is they're working with and the usability of what they're working with, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
But, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing, too, mm-hmm. is, you know, you think you have one good hand, and then,
right.
you know, the whole time I wasn't thinking that something was going to happen. It didn't even dawn on me until I thought, oh, man, that's not good.
Yeah.
And then now it's like, I think they have those cortisone patches.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't think about like this.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you
can
test usually away.
Yeah. This is not thing that someone without one hand can't do. So even without the use of their hand, if I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. If I didn't have the use of my hand at all, I'd easily amputate my arm. I've thought about amputation nonstop for the first 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the way that they're constantly dragging is such a pain in the butt.
Okay. And something that I just want to point out now also about listening to what your users have to say. A lot of times we get hung up about, like, the truth, you know. Are they saying, like, what's really happening, or do they really mean it, or, you know, or any of that. And really what's the key is to look into, well, why did they say something that they did, you know, whether or not they actually ended up doing whatever it is that they say that they meant. So that's another tip to keep in mind.
So you guys might have noticed there's a bunch of needs that we tried to represent in those short clips. And you might try and see if the needs that you found were the same needs that Gene and I found. I mean, granted, we took a lot more time and did a lot more research. But so we started by thinking about the top. What are the meaning needs? If we're going to create something for these people, what do we need to create? What kind of higher level needs do we need to address? This idea about need to be able to trust something, to be able to trust whatever you're working with and to be able to trust yourself was huge. You might have heard a little bit of that. Especially with Chris, this need to be normal. He had an accident 5 years ago, I think, just last month. And it was really important to him that he feel normal. Not that he has to be normal, but he has to feel normal. And also this need to have beautiful things. These are people that don't want to have something that looks like an assistive device necessarily. What's interesting with this project is you started looking at cutting bread. We went in and talked to these people, and as often happens in a design project, you go in with one thing in mind, and if you really listen to people, you might end up going in a different direction. So we ended up working on cookware, pots and pans. So specifically for those, we came up with some needs, like using the helper hand that you heard Ramona talking about, protecting your strong hand. That's what Joan was talking about. She had tendonitis because she'd overused her hand. Something that somebody like me that has both hands that work very well, hasn't happened to me. And also just being able to lift and move heavy pots and pans around. And then we get down to the details. These are all the nitty-gritty things to make whatever we design really function well. And, you know, grasping it ergonomically. It's definitely where ergonomics comes into play. So this is a picture of Chris's cutting board. You might have noticed it in the video. And Chris got this cutting board not too long after his accident. He learned how to use it a few times, and then it went into the back of a cabinet. Never used it again until we started asking him about cooking, and we asked him if he had any of these products, and then he brought it out for us. Why did he not use it? It fulfilled all the functions that he needed, but it didn't meet the higher level, the meaning needs. It didn't make him feel normal. It wasn't a beautiful thing. I don't think any of us would say this was particularly beautiful. It also didn't make him feel safe. He didn't trust it. Those things that look like they're nails pretty much are nails. And you weren't really sure on that lever that locks things in place whether it was locked or not. So this is an example of something that fulfills the function and the usability but does not fulfill the meaning. And as a result, it was not successful. So what you get out of need finding is what we like to call design principles. And you use those to guide where your project goes. And of course, you want to fulfill all the functions, but this is really getting at the idea of the meaning. What else needs to be implicit in whatever you create to make it successful? So these are the design principles you've used to come up with this pot. And I'm not going to go into too much detail now because we're running a little over. But things like just avoiding the color white to increase desirability. You know, white had a lot of associations for these people. Medical devices, the hospital, these were all things they didn't want to have in their home. So that was really important to us, as well as confidence and simplicity. And there's a lot of, we kind of put the details in about how we tried to achieve that. And we'd love to talk to you guys about this pot later if you'd like. But you can pick it up. So these are the takeaways that we want you guys to remember. If you can do these five things, we think it could really help any project. Spend a lot of time with people. Just get in there, get in their space, go to their homes where they're doing things, and just spend time with them, and things will pop out. Ask questions like, what is the job of this product? And that's something like if you looked at the cutting board and the knife, what is the job of that product? If you really start to dig deep into what those needs might be, you might figure out that the job of a cutting board and a knife is more about cutting your own food and making it wholesome. That's why she wasn't going to buy the sliced bread for the 3 months that she couldn't, that Leah didn't have the use of her arm. Remembering what Jean was talking about, need versus solution, if you really try and think about things in that verb form, it's going to give you a lot more options. Asking questions, how and why, to open up that problem space, to get up at the higher level needs as well as getting down to all those details. And then remember that users have all the answers. You know, if you're especially working in a team and you disagree on something, take it to the users. They'll be able to answer those questions for you. But you have to ask the right questions. So you don't want to just go up to them, as Jean was saying, and say, what do you need? Because you're not really going to get the sort of rich information. You need to kind of let that flow. But things that are really helpful are to give people an option. Do you like this or do you like this? You know, so this is our classic one. You know, we bring them back some options. Do you like this or do you like this? And then you get a little bit more truth out of your answers.
Okay, so...
able to give you a few tips. We want to try to boost your confidence with how useful need finding is by showing you like a few products out there in the market that are already have employed need finding and have really helped revolutionize, I guess, that product area. For instance, vegetable potato peelers, pretty normal looking, OXO was able to use need finding through the designers. Actually, was working on trying to improve a peeler for his wife, who happened to be arthritic and also big into cooking. And he was able to tap into some needs that everyone, you know, would be able to appreciate. And just as Terry mentioned, they have a whole line of products that that have been, you know, selling really great. Toothbrushes. Typical old-style toothbrush. Through need finding with kids, they were able to look at, you know, well, what would make it easier to grasp, you know, something, a larger handle, and also the angle of it, you know, watching children trying to, like, you know, learn how to brush their teeth really helped reveal some details and features that were actual needs for everyone. Another example is Clorox. They did some need finding with teenagers, and discovered that teenagers are, or at least the latest one, when they came up with the disposable wipes, our disposable generation, that really believe that, you know, I could use something for however long I need, and then I can throw it out. And so they came up with disposable wipes to address that those needs. And then lastly, for a long time, Pampers really dominated the diaper market. And Huggies, you know, rather than study babies or toddlers, they decided to look into studying parents more closely. And they found there was this huge unaddressed need for parents and what diapers for their children really meant. And that it was actually only a stepping stone to their growth and their, you know, ability to grow up. So to parents, they needed to feel like they were successful and that they were able to potty train their children. And so that helped them feel like good parents. So they came up with pull-ups, which opened a whole new section of the diaper industry that said, you know, not only do we provide, like, highly high-tech functioning diapers, but we're able to help parents meet their needs to feel like they're doing a good job in raising their children. So these are all some examples out there that are show how need finding can really benefit users across the board, and we think that you could use these tools as well to help make your projects unique and exciting. So, if you have any questions,
thank you. I actually have a comment. It seems that your thinking about need finding is much more general than just for people with disabilities. It serves, you know, any kind of device or thing that you're going to do, but it also has application in for other products that could be more just engineering type things as well. You have to ask, you know, who's going to use it, you know, how are they going to interact with it and stuff. So it's your concepts are extremely general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that a lot of times people with people who need an assistive device are used as an extreme user, what we like to call an extreme user, because it does magnify some needs. But I think the key is to be able to do that sort of research and then really find the needs that are implicit for everybody, and then you get those products that Terry's asking for, something that the cost goes down significantly because you're selling it to a broader market. You're selling it to everybody.
That's great. If you want to come up and take a look at this product, you're welcome to do so. If you have to leave, see you next week. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm.